We're good. When Bigfoot says we're good, we're good. And so we're doing this now. Good to see you, Sanjula.
You too, Commissioner.
Busy week. Lots going on.
Always a lot going on.
Always a lot going on from all ends.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Good stuff. So let's see. We've had a lot of great meetings, and you've been jumping internal, external, all over the place. So we had a good CNPV, making a lot of good progress on the CNPV program.
Yeah, great start. Really went very smoothly. So I'm excited about that. And the next group of medications we'll announce, that'll be recipients. Right now we're sorting through all the nominations that come from the divisions internally. So I'm excited about that.
Good. And then you also did some speaking at the Association of Accessible Medicines. Tell us about
that. Amazing group of largely biosimilar manufacturers. I think there were about 2,000 folks there. Amazing people. I mean, I learn a lot when we're out there meeting with people, and I think that's important. We need to be out there listening. I mean, we need to be here working, too. But that balance of how much time do you spend out there circulating versus spending here, I think we hit a great balance this week because we did both. It's an amazing group of people. We met with the board in addition to my meeting with the broader group and speaking.
Yep. And so I think for our audience who may not be familiar, so let's unpack, you know, you were there also to make an announcement on biosimilar reform. So first, what is a biosimilar?
So look, a biosimilar is a molecule that is essentially a type of generic version of a biologic. Now, there's all sorts of people that watch this podcast. Let me back up for a second. Healthcare costs are going up. They talk about it all the time in this town. Healthcare costs are going up, and the fastest area of healthcare spending growth is drug price inflation. And the fastest area of drug price inflation is biologics. It's now over 50% of drug spend, even though biologics are about 5% of the medicines prescribed. Biologics are expensive in part because they're amazing. They use cell lines to be produced, and that's expensive.
So these are things for like cancer and certain types
of autoimmune diseases. I've seen it used in post-transplant recipients. They're amazing medications. They work wonders. I had the privilege of seeing it firsthand as a clinician when I was practicing. So, look, we should all be thankful. And the companies that bring biologics to market, we should be thanking those companies. They're not the bad guys. They're the good guys.
Right.
But when that 12 years of exclusivity expires, we want to see low-cost alternatives come to market. The generic versions, if you will, and those are called biosimilars when it comes to biologics. When it's small molecules, we just call them branded and generic medications. But with biologics, there's this new class that started getting approved by the FDA 10 years ago called biosimilars. And they make these biologic drugs, at least the force of these biologic drugs, the benefits. Biosimilars make those benefits affordable to many people, and that means they're more accessible.
So they're usually about 50% on average of the cost of a biologic medicine, right?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, when Humira, a famous biologic, had their exclusivity expire, it took 7 years for the first biosimilar to come to market. And then even when one came to market, you didn't see the price budge that much. It might have been, some have argued, an implied price collusion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to make that statement myself. But once you started having a couple, 3-4 biosimilars to compete, you started to see that price come down. Now, there are biosimilars that are sold for a fraction of the price of expensive biologics. Biologics should be charging what they need to recover R&D, but sometimes the price goes way up. When Humira came out, it was $5,000. It was tens of thousands of dollars. $40,000 sometimes over different points in time. And so what is that number needed to recoup R&D? Look, we're not going to get involved in the price that companies set, but we do want competition. We want biosimilars on the market. We want lower cost alternatives, because if the biologic is incredibly effective for somebody, but they can't afford it, the effectiveness for that individual is zero.
Right. So to paint that picture then, so for those who may have missed the announcement this week, so my understanding is that about 20% of, there's only 20% market penetration of these lower cost generic versions of the biologics. And so there was a big reform you announced this week with draft guidance. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that's the money right there. I need to get right to it. So, and you're right, first of all, only about 10% of biologics that are going to come off their exclusivity in the next 10 years have a biosimilar in development. It should be 30, 40% plus. And Europe has more biosimilars approved than the United States.
And they got a 15-year head start on us as well.
They started earlier, and there are more in Europe. And so we have to examine the regulatory hurdles that are preventing more biosimilars from coming to market safely. And so we announced this recently at this conference that we are going to be removing some of those regulatory hurdles. For example, the comparative study that we've historically required, we don't require it for generics, small molecule generics. We say, look, if it's the same molecule, we are comfortable with that. So we're going to take the 5 to 8 year time frame for a new biosimilar to come to market. We're going to cut it in half. It'll be, 2.5 to 5 years. The companies that we talked to at the association felt very comfortable that they're going to be able to cut that time in half given this new regulatory draft guidance. And then also with interchangeability, we announced that we're going to take a strong position to support interchangeability. That is allowing pharmacists and patients to make the decision together to switch to a biosimilar instead of a biologic if that's desirable for the patient. It may be all that they can afford.
Which does already happen for small molecules today, right?
Right.
You go to the pharmacy and your pharmacist can give you that lower cost one, right, but they can't for these others.
Right.
Okay.
Now, look, I had heard from people in the industry over the last several years that the cost to bring a biosimilar to market is about $200 million. The amazing thing about listening and being at that meeting with the board and the makers of biosimilars, is that they were really specific and granular on exactly how much money this reform is going to save them in the development process. As low as $20 million, but the most common answer I heard was the number is closer to $100 million. Yeah. Now, for a medication that costs between $200 million to develop to $300 million to develop, saving $100 million is a big deal. And when you lower these R&D costs, it also lowers the price of drugs, ideally because there's you don't have that cost to pass on and recover in the price of the medication.
So by eliminating that kind of study requirement, which we don't have for the small molecule generics, we're reducing the development costs. That's a good thing for developers, but then we're also going to translate down to the everyday American patient.
That's right. So I think it's a win. We've gotten great feedback on this, and so just an exhilarating time. We're going to keep doing this stuff. We've been thinking about it, but we've got to socialize it. A big shout out to Mustafa and Sarah here at the FDA, who were very instrumental. And, you know, this is the way to do things. You don't come in on day one and just announce 100 reforms. You've got to make sure you're doing it the right way and talk to the people here, get everybody's input, and then make a decision.
Yeah, and it was amazing listening to you give those remarks at that conference. By my count, there were kind of three kind of standing ovation applauses, right? Because this was such a big moment for the industry, right? They've been waiting for this and wanting for this for years, and it's not been done. So kudos to you for making that
happen. That was cool. That was a great meeting. It was great to get that feedback. I'm most excited about its implications for Medicare and Medicaid, because once you start seeing more substitution with biosimilars, or at least allowing patients to choose biosimilars, and there are creative ways now that some insurance companies are structuring your choice. So if you choose the biosimilar, you may have a lower copay because they are saving a lot of money when you choose the biosimilar. They may want to pass that savings on in the form of the copay. You could see lower health insurance premiums as a result. And so this fits with that broader mission that we have right now, where we are hot to lower drug prices a ton for everyday Americans. That's the most favored nation status work at CMS. It's our work to say if you can make your medication affordable, we're going to favor that. We're going to like that. We're going to try to support that. and to move manufacturing to the United States. So it really fits beautifully with that broader vision, because if you think about what the world of healthcare talks about, they talk about that we have a broken healthcare system that has a ton of waste. And what the conversations have been relegated to in the policy circles is how much money to throw into that broken system.
Yep.
This is actually addressing one of the root issues, and that is the price of goods and services in healthcare. And the other piece, of course, is the health of the population, which is a big focus of MAHA.
It's exciting. And, you know, I have to say on the CMS point, when you made this announcement, you did it also with Dr. Oz, right?
Yes.
And so, you know, it's great to see the two agencies be aligned in trying to make this actually happen.
He's an interesting dude. Have you spent time with him?
Not very much.
I mean, honestly, one of the smartest doctors I have ever met was vice chair of surgery at Columbia. We had surgical residents go to Columbia for their cardiac surgery fellowship, and they would operate with them. And because Oz started getting into general health promotion and doing things on television, we were all curious, how are Dr. Oz's technical skills? And, you know, some people might be jealous he's on TV. You kind of want the answer to be, you know, well, he's not that great in the operating room. No, our residents that went up there were like, he is as smooth and slick and technically savvy as any of the greatest cardiac surgeons in the world. And he actually trained, I found out, and this is all stuff I'm learning, spending time with him. He had trained with Dr. Carpentier, with the greatest cardiac surgeons in the history of medicine. And so he's just a fascinating guy that's interested in psychiatry and obstetrics and internal medicine and autoimmune diseases and pediatrics. And he's spent time researching all that in the health promotion work he's done. But he's also an incredibly accomplished academic physician. So he's just a fascinating guy, the smartest doctor I've ever met.
Yeah, well, it's a privilege for people like me who get to be at work, you know, with the two of you and, you know, observe and learn a lot of this. I mean, your recall of all these stats, and I know we were prepping for this announcement, and, you know, he was citing all these studies he had just read. I'm like, when did you have time to read this?
Oh, popcorn, just nonstop.
Yeah, but it's great to see the alignment, and I think that's going to actually translate to lower prices for everyday Americans, which
he's
is so
committed.
Important.
Look, he's committed, and we have a charge from this president. This president's not interested in reducing drug prices by 1% or 2%.
Yep.
He's interested in massive reductions where now Americans can buy direct, bypass the middlemen or the PBMs.
Yep.
And that's the basis of their TrumpRx curated website. You can buy directly from this pharmaceutical manufacturer. Genius. Now, look, if you love PBMs and you want to pay a higher price, then that option will be there. But now we have another option.
Yeah.
And so that's exciting.
Yeah, so these have been some really big reforms, you know, on Most Favored Nation, the biosimilar reform, all of this around drug affordability. But there are a lot of other drug reforms that you've really been challenging the agency here to be thinking about moving forward. And some of them, you know, the average person may not realize have an implication, right, on getting the development costs, timelines down and the costs down. So, for example, just a couple days ago, we made this announcement around filing checklists, right? Do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah. I'll try to explain this one to the general public. So when you submit an application to the FDA, we spend up to 2 months just making sure it's complete. Something, and it's the tool we use is something called a filing checklist. So we now live in the modern era, and so we can make this filing checklist public so sponsors can have it and go through it themselves before they submit it. And also we can do this in a much more automated fashion.
30 seconds.
Okay, well, I guess we're running out of time here.
Oh, okay. I guess we got a meeting coming up.
Yeah.
All right.
Got a busy calendar.
The Galien Foundation Forum, that was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a great part of last week. And then the Cancer CEO Roundtable, great to hear from the Cancer Center directors, sat down with them. A bunch of them actually happened to be in the same area of surgical oncology as me. That's coincidence. I don't think that's by design.
Is there anything that you guys talked about that's kind of shaping your thinking?
We talked about the uncinate of the pancreas. We talked about healthcare costs and the struggles they have and how we can reform clinical trials by having more streamlined hospital contracting and central IRBs. The amount of delays from the hospital contracting process and the decentralized nature when you want to run a trial in 8 centers, You got to do this back and forth with each of the hospital's teams of lawyers. And then the decentralized IRBs, you know, they're volunteer boards where you have doctors sitting in a committee once a month, and then they don't get to it, then it gets bumped to the next month. I don't know if I told you, I had an IRB proposal at Johns Hopkins for a research study. I wanted to do a survey of patients, and it took a year and a half, and in the end, it was actually rejected.
Jeez.
It was a survey. Like, what danger is that survey going to do? It was like a survey on their eating habits and patterns.
This is one of the reasons I couldn't stay in academia, because there's just so many paperwork steps and things you have to do just to be able to do what you want to be doing.
You know, I thought bureaucracy was really unique to the government. It's not. It's unique to organizations proportional to the size of an organization. So you get any large organizations.
Yeah.
But speaking of which, on the topic of nutrition, we did meet with the American Heart Association last week. Great meeting. We are meeting with different stakeholders around the topic of food, and we are gearing up for the announcement of our dietary guidelines. We're rewriting the food pyramid, and we're going to do it in a way that's much more evidence-based, not a food pyramid that's written by industry based on the products they want you to buy. This will be based on some really good expertise that we're getting.
Good.
And it's going to be exciting.
Yeah, I think it's amazing that it's such a collaborative process and getting input from all the relevant folks.
We're trying to keep it short, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 pages.
The current one is a couple hundred pages?
200,
yeah.
I think. But if it's four or five pages, you'll have a ton of people read it and understand it. If it's 200 pages, very few people are going to read it.
I think it's going to be huge, because those guidelines then determine, you know, what school lunch programs and everything else that follows from that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exciting time.
Yeah. Good. You've been busy, man. You have gear shift a lot. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Now, thanks for all your support and help here, San Angeles. So I guess they're pulling at me to go to this meeting. Hope it's a good meeting.
Do we have a minute? I think there was one other thing we forgot to catch up on.
Halloween.
Fluoride.
Fluoride. Okay. The best way to prevent cavities is good dental hygiene. The downside of infants taking fluoride tablets is that it's now known to alter the microbiome. That is the garden of bacteria, billion plus bacteria that live in the gut, that live in an equilibrium. And it is increasingly recognized now that the microbiome is a central organ to health and so many organ systems. It's involved.
It's all about gut health.
Gut health. So So it is far better to engage in good dental hygiene than to simply send a fluoride tablet down the GI tract of a child when that microbiome is forming, given what we know now about how fluoride tablets do alter the microbiome. So we did take action to say now that we no longer include in the label an indication for fluoride in kids under 3 or kids with access to dental hygiene.
Yeah, and I know the team published a big scientific report that walks through all the evidence around it. It's really eye-opening to see some of the different studies there.
Yeah, look, they're all God's children arguing about this issue, but on one hand, you have a dental community saying it reduces cavities, and on the other hand, you have people saying, yeah, but we don't know what it's doing to overall health. And we do have studies now that show kids that take antibiotics in the first few years of life have higher rates of atopic dermatitis, of asthma, of obesity, of other chronic conditions. And it's believed that one of the reasons why that association was seen in the Mayo Clinic study is that antibiotics are also altering the microbiome. In fact, fluoride may be essentially a bactericidal agent. The same reason it may reduce cavities or bacteria kills bacteria on teeth is it's maybe killing bacteria in the microbiome. So,
well, Thanksgiving dinner, my sister's a dentist, so we're going to be having this
debate.
You're
going to have that debate. Good, yeah. Good. Debates are good. We love them.
Yeah, good. Well, I know it's also almost lunchtime too, so last fun question for you, since you're talking about the microbiome. How do you keep a healthy gut microbiome? Do you like eat anything in particular or take probiotics?
I think whole foods bound to fiber, grains bound to fiber. I think, I generally want as few chemicals in my food as possible. And I think this sounds a little cheesy, but I think you want to avoid antibiotics unless they're really necessary. The average 10-year-old in the United States has already had multiple courses of antibiotics. Are they all necessary? No. Study after study shows that half of antibiotics prescribed are not clinically necessary. That's repeatedly established in the literature. And we all know what's going on. There's a consumerist culture. So that's what I do.
Interesting. Great. Well, okay, I've kept you long enough. Okay. So.
All right. Well, enjoy your lunch. I'm going to run to this meeting. Great to see you, Sanjula. Thanks, folks, for taking a little time with us. This is our fun part. If we get done with our work early, we say, hey, let's shoot out here and just chat. So this is the fun part of the day. So thanks, everybody.